Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, December 22nd, 2025 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. This week, I'll start with the From the Editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. After that, I'll read an article from the Humanity Behind the Headlines section, and then the Explainer, the Home Forum, and then finally, the Monitor's View. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled, A Newspaper Based on Unshakable Ideals. This is written by Chris Takace Bryant, who's the editor, Kurt Schillinger, who's a managing editor, Kenny D. Evelyn, who's a managing publisher, and Casey Fetty, who's a product manager. And they all write, At a time when shifting corporate interests, market forces, and demographic trends are buffeting many news organizations, the Christian Science Monitor is different. We are published by a church, and that means our work is based on unshakable ideals that aren't swayed by the latest algorithm. As we begin our 118th year of publication, our new leadership team is working to both articulate these ideals and enable the sort of journalism that best encapsulates our mission in today's news ecosystem. To do this, we've been going back to our founding documents from 1908, when Mary Baker Eddy established the Christian Science Monitor. Our founder wrote that she established the Christian Science Monitor to spread undivided the science that operates unspent. What does that mean? Many of us over the years have grappled with this. We know that she used that term, science, to refer to the operation of divine law and human thought and action. The rest of the phrasing, spread undivided and operates unspent, echoes the 18th century British poet Alexander Pope, who used those words in his masterwork, An Essay on Man, Epistle I, to say that God's creative and benevolent force is everywhere at once, neither diminishing nor separated. So what does this have to do with journalism? Prior editors have interpreted this as a charge to focus on the good that men do and not the evil, as Archibald McLellan wrote in 1908, to raise the standard of thought among readers, to focus on progress rather than problems, to investigate the deep values underlying news events. Here are our five new operational guidelines that we've been drawn from this history. We have committed to bring a healing, a purifying thought to many homes. We counteract cynicism about news and humanity by upholding a higher standard of both. Get above the fray. We are free from corporate and political interests, and our journalism will reflect this. Cover the day's vital global news. We provide a trustworthy and concise compilation for our thoughtful, busy readers. Investigate ideals and endeavors, not just events. We keep abreast of the times by recognizing key currents of thought and their impact. And to be clean, family-friendly, and non-sensational, we are a newspaper for the home. For this season of gratitude and rejoicing, and indeed throughout the year, we see our mission as our daily charge. We see it as our founder's gift to all of humanity. And that was From the Editor column, this week written by a foursome, Chris Takace Bryant, who's an editor, Kurt Schillinger, managing editor, Kenny DeEvelin is a managing publisher, and Casey Fetty is a product manager. And this week it was entitled, A Newspaper Based on Unshakable Ideals. And now for the cover story. It is entitled, Memories Wrapped in the Glow of Tradition. Glad Tidings from Dad, Each Christmas Eve. Now, it's written by a whole bunch of people. There's a whole bunch of short, 4 or 5 paragraph articles. So here we go. Here's the first one. Like many families, we, La Franchise, have our unshakable Christmas traditions, the activities and artifacts without which the holiday would not be ours. There's a review of the nativity sets we've collected from around the world to be augmented this year by new entries from Kenya and El Salvador. There's the baking and decorating of the Buche de Noel using a Texas recipe we've remained faithful to since first trying it out in our diminutive Paris kitchen in 1992. And then there is what is referred to as Dad's story. And that's when we all stop whatever we're doing, and Dad, that would be me, reads a seasonal story on Christmas Eve. The repertoire is limited, with works by an exclusive group of writers who have earned their way into our festive hearts. O. Henry, Capote, Singer, and a lesser-known Sylvia Seymour, a kin of Memphis, Tennessee. To understand how Dad's story became a family tradition, let's go back to Christmas Eve 1974, to my childhood home in Northern California. I was a college student questioning our Western culture of mass consumption, and as Christmas approached, I thought of our family's previous Christmas Eve, which I recalled as a whirlwind of untied ribbons and bows, torn wrapping paper, and collapsed gift boxes. Then as now, I like opening a gift as much as anyone, but I also thought there had to be a way to remember what the day and the season are about, something like grace. So I announced to our family, my parents, my siblings, their spouses, and children, that this Christmas we would begin something different. I opened our old black leather-bound LaFranchi family Bible and read from Matthew the story of the first Christmas. Now, many decades later, I often think back to that Christmas Eve and the transformation I sensed the reading of a story produced as I hunt for my copy of The Gift of the Magi, A Christmas Memory, or Zaleth the Goat. I know my family will be expecting a story that is an indelible part of our Christmas. And that was written by Howard LaFranchi, who's a staff writer. And the next one, Comfort and Joy Across the Continents. The memory that lingers most from my childhood winters in northern India is the way my mother transformed the chilliest time of the year into a season of comfort and warmth. A country emerging from a colonialism did not have a week-long holiday, but as the year came to an end and temperatures dropped, our evenings centered around my mother's cooking and the angithi, a traditional coal brazier. My mother made foods meant to warm the body from the inside out. She made crunchy bars of sesame seeds and ground peanuts, slow-roasted sweet potatoes nestled in charcoal until the embers faded, and laddus, a sweet with fried nuts and warming spices, whose fragrance filled the air. We sat in a circle, warming our hands as rounds of chai simmered with fresh ginger, cinnamon, cloves, and cardamom. Even with limited resources, we knew it was also the season to spread warmth. We had an unspoken family tradition of sharing with those less fortunate and regularly donated blankets to homeless people. Moving to the United States reshaped these rituals, but didn't erase them. Now I keep my family's spirit alive in smaller ways. Once a year, I make the traditional North Indian dessert, Gajar Ka Halwa, letting grated carrots simmer for hours in milk before adding sugar, nuts, and cardamom. I invite friends over and we exchange our own seasonal treats. Sometimes that means Indian delicacies, sometimes Middle Eastern, with the flaky sweetness of a baklava. And there is regularly a quintessential American dessert, the pie that we have come to love in all the different flavors. Chai with warming spices remains the anchor, a reminder of childhood memories as we share stories of our lives. But the moment it feels most heartwarming is outside my home in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My Diwali lights, usually kept up until the new year, mingling with my neighbors' Christmas displays. Their soft glow reminds me that I now live in a world where cultures can sit side by side, each holding its own warmth, together illuminating the dark of winter. And that was written by Kalpana Jain, who is a contributor. And our next one is entitled, Alone or Together, Take Time to Rest and Recover. I remember the first time hearing the emotions cold yet compelling classic, What Do the Lonely Do at Christmas? I was a kid riding in my parents' blue Chevrolet Astro van, and I didn't understand why the lady singing was so sad during the holidays. Originally released in the 1970s as a song about heartbreak, the song had been used over the years as a standard to describe the feelings of people who find themselves isolated during late November and the month of December. This is unfortunate because there is a simple answer to what people do by themselves on Christmas. whatever they want. When it comes to the holidays, aloneness should not always be seen as a cry for help. For some, it can be quite the intentional effort. Don't get me wrong, as an extrovert, I love holiday gatherings. Spending time with family and friends at the end of the year feels essential, especially with folks having similar off days from work. But something equally important is having time off to rest and recover, and time to reflect and plan for the upcoming year. It can be easier to clear your mind in isolation, away from the holiday hustle and bustle. While some people bemoan holiday depression, I'm proposing that we also consider holiday decompression. What does that look like for me? It looks like reading a good book and unplugging from the phone and the constant demands of family life for a few fleeting moments. Sometimes it looks like doing absolutely nothing, and that's okay. Nurturing both sides of holiday time, the quiet and the crowd, can create the sort of balance that's helpful all year long. After all, there are times when some people need a hug or a warm meal. And there are times when others just want the room to grow or grieve. We can be there for others and ourselves, regardless of the season. And that was written by Ken Macon, who is a cultural commentator. And our next one, we are the Original Rap Stars, and that's WRAP. As a kid, I spent every Christmas with my family at my grandparents' expansive farm outside Wheeling, West Virginia. Because their small town was unincorporated without garbage pickup, all trash was either composted or burned. My grandmother, a thrifty New Englander, and my grandfather, a prudent politician, believed that wrapping gifts only to burn the wrapping paper was an extravagant waste of time and money. So our family would, quote-unquote, wrap our gifts in the most deceptive bag possible. Think of receiving a new sweater in a grocery store bag, a teddy bear in a restaurant takeout bag. As my siblings and I entered our teens, finding gift wrapping bags from upscale stores became a year-round game. At a friend's house, my sister saw a bag from a high-end clothing retailer heading for the trash. "Wait, can I have that bag?" she asked, much to the surprise of her host. That bag found new life on Christmas morning, concealing a skillet for Mom. The farm has long since been sold, and my siblings and I have started our own families in towns with reliable garbage service. But we have carried on the Christmas no-wrap wrapping tradition. At least a few times during the year, I'll find myself admiring a bag that housed a recent purchase, thinking, "This will be perfect for Christmas." And that was written by Lauren Crandell, who is a contributor. And our next one is entitled, Savoring a Night of No Cooking. The comforts of home and tradition don't always involve a ladle and a pot. In our family, Christmas Eve is when we create space for gratitude and togetherness, and it begins with a simple decision. We don't cook. Instead, we order out, giving the kitchen the night off until Christmas morning. What began decades ago when my parents were newlyweds who couldn't afford plane tickets home has become one of our most cherished holiday traditions. That first Christmas Eve, alone and far from family, they called in an order for a simple comfort meal, Chinese takeout. At a time when to-do lists can unfurl like long satin ribbons and the sequence of holiday events often weaves together like a tightly spun cable-knit sweater, there's quiet relief in doing nothing more ambitious than deciding whether to get an extra order of sweet and sour chicken. The answer is yes. It's like swapping that wool cardigan for your favorite cotton hoodie. Now, each year we gather with chopsticks around cartons of crispy spring rolls, crab ragoon, little bowls of egg drop soup, and dishes piled high with fried rice and chow mein to savor not just the food, but a brief pause. After dinner, we sit in a circle on the floor or curled up on couches and take turns sharing a meaningful Christmas tidbit, a poem, song, short story, or a belly laugh that's been waiting for the right moment. There's no pressure or performance, just a casual night that belongs to everyone, friends and neighbors welcome. What started with a call for comfort food to a family-run restaurant down the road has sparked a ritual that celebrates the simple joy of being together. The best part? no one has to wash the dishes. And that was written by Stephanie Cook Broadhurst, who's a contributor. And the next one, The Gift of No Gift. It's this year's hottest holiday item, but I'm afraid you won't be able to find it in stores or online, and even if you could somehow manage to track it down, you wouldn't be able to wrap your arms around it. That's because it's nothing. I mean that literally. It's the gift of no gift. A few Christmases ago, my wife's side of the family realized that we all wanted the same thing, to slow things down and find some time to actually enjoy the holidays again. We decided to remove one of the season's biggest time sucks and stressors, finding the, quote, right gift, unquote, for adults who don't want anything, know exactly what they want, and there's no chance it's what you have in mind, or tell you exactly what to give them, so they might as well be looking over your shoulder while you hit place your order on Amazon. So meaningful. Hence, the gift of no gift. There are two caveats. Caveat number one, gifts for kids are still in play. And caveat number two, although gifts for adults are generally frowned upon, if you stumble across, not hunt for, something really special and reasonably priced, and you can go ahead and get it. Thanks to the conditions established by the gift of no gift, e.g. no gifts, your find becomes a true gift because there's no expectation of reciprocity. This approach isn't about throwing a wet blanket on the festivities of the season. It's about getting the right kind of holiday cheer to the right people. And in my experience, this mutual pact to inaction has cut down significantly on holiday stress. If you want a number, I'd say about 30 to 40%. So this holiday season, give your loved ones something really special. Give them nothing. And in doing so, give them time, peace, and presence. That's P-R-E-S-E-N-C-E. That was written by Zach Priestup, who's a contributor. And our next one is entitled, Instead of Another Necktie, Try Dad Dates. After my daughter and son grew up and moved away, I asked them to stop buying me presents for Christmas. My wife and I are empty nesters who want our home to be even emptier, with more space and less clutter. For us, limiting new stuff makes lots of sense. We also want our children to invest in their futures rather than splurging on yet another necktie for dad or sweater for mom. Still, gift-giving is one of the world's great pleasures, so I let my children lavish me with generosity. But instead of presenting me with a bright new thing, they give me the gift of time. Dad dates are our holiday tradition. The concept is simple. During their trips home for the holidays, each of my children plans an hour or two focused one-on-one time with me. One evening, at my request, my daughter sat with me near the tree, opened her laptop, and slowly walked me through the ideas she's brainstormed as part of her interior design job. We had many phone conversations about her work, but while wandering around in her blueprints, I could both see her professional world and dwell within it. It was a marvel to discover the person she'd become. I had a similar experience when my son, a roboticist, let me look over his shoulder one Yuletide afternoon as he wrote computer code. His universe is markedly different from the one I inhabit as a journalist, and our time together helped me see that as a cause for celebration. It reminded me that for all our family ties, he's become his own distinct person, and a wonderful one at that. Not all of our holiday dad dates are about career catch-ups. I sometimes ask my daughter to show me her funniest online humor, and we laugh ourselves silly watching cat videos and TV bloopers. My son and I have had some of our best dad dates screening vintage James Bond movies. Anticipating my Christmas dad dates makes me smile. I know I'll be getting time with two people I love, the best gift of all. And that was written by Danny Heitman, who's a contributor. And our next one is entitled, Two Cultures, Twice the Delight. If you were to ask my children about holiday traditions here in Mexico, they'd probably mention the colorful, star-like piñatas tied atop cars making their way to posadas, or Christmas parties around the city. they might point out that a lot of their friends receive their extra special gifts on Three Kings Day in January. And without fail, they would tell you about Semichlaus. Semichlaus is not actually a Mexican tradition, but a Swiss one that my children have taken part in since they were babies, thanks to Swiss-Mexican neighbors who host an annual party. But to my Mexican-born children, the story of Semichlaus is all theirs. My eldest spends the morning of the party helping make fluffy white bread shaped like a man and decorated with nuts and raisins. The rest of us arrive in the late afternoon to devour a magnificent barley stew and munch on sausages sourced from a German butcher especially for the event. We socialize in Spanish, but our hosts call out to her kids in the Swiss-German dialect, and I ask my children in English if they've eaten enough. Just as the sun sets, we hear a silvery sweet ringing of a handbell. Semichlaus has arrived. According to folklore, the figure of Semichlaus travels across a vast forest, talking with the birds, squirrels, deer, and other animals that have been keeping an eye on the children over the course of the year. Each child is called to the front of the room to give the person representing Semichlaus a gift, perhaps a drawing, a written poem, or a singing performance. Then Semichlaus gives each child a spirited compliment sandwich. Here's what you did well this year, and here is what you should work on next year. The precision in his feedback is so spot on. One of my daughters correctly predicted last year he'd be encouraging her to work on her table manners. I leave this party each year so warmed by the community my family has built here in Mexico. But it also makes me think about bigger questions about identity and belonging. When my babies are adults looking back at their childhood, how will it make them feel? Will they feel Mexican because they're born and raised here? Will they feel American because that's the culture those raising them know best? Or will it be some kind of mix? Perhaps my kids will even grow up feeling something akin to the folkloric figure of Semichlaus, with acceptance and kindness for this vast, ever-changing world. That was written by Whitney Ulick, who is a special correspondent. And our next one is entitled, How We Upped Our Holiday Game. A few years ago, my husband and I started hosting Christmas at our house for extended family and friends. After the annual feast and exchange of gifts, I watched as everyone drifted apart by generation. The younger kids ran upstairs, the grandmas began to tidy up, and everyone else settled around the TV to watch Elf. I felt like our time together was becoming a blur of wrapping paper and abandoned solo cups, so one year I asked each group to bring their favorite board game. Games have always played a big role in our lives. When my kids were in school, they would meet up with friends online in Fortnite or Minecraft. Their holiday wish lists reflected that: gaming chairs, headsets, light-up keyboards. As a child, I loved to play dominoes with my grandparents. It was the only time I had their undivided attention, and my papa, always my teammate, would wink and kick me under the table if he had a good hand. There's something about playing the game that makes it easy for people to be together. It doesn't require eye contact or conversation, just a willingness to sit together and connect. The first year that everyone brought a board game, not everyone wanted to play. There was plenty of room as we pushed two tables together and dragged a couple of chairs from the kitchen. We had a stack of games to choose from: Catchphrase, Taboo, Gestures, Family Feud, and we split up into teams with blue or yellow post-it notes stuck to our shirts so we could tell who was on which side. After years of listening to our offspring yell into headsets, we were now the rowdy ones, cheering our teammates on. The kids, curious about the commotion, drifted in and out, smiling at the adult revelry. Over the years, the table grew. The younger generation joins us now as we all crowd onto benches. Some reserve their seats early with a dessert plate or drink, and my mother-in-law parks her wheelchair on the periphery to watch. Game time is now a highlight of our annual gathering. Being part of something, whether it's two people or 20, is what makes the holidays meaningful. And that was from Courtney Rudzinski, who was a contributor. And our next one, showing love through the thoughtful gestures. My childhood Christmases were idyllic. We sat on Santa's lap at the mall, sang Christmas carols at church and on Advent Sundays, gathered with extended family on Christmas Eve, and raced down the stairs on Christmas morning to discover what treasures had appeared by the fireplace. My older brother and I stayed in our pajamas half the day playing with our new toys. For years, I lived inside the blissful naivety of a happy holiday movie. Almost a decade ago, my brother passed away. In the years since, I have lost friends, and my best friend lost her son. Grief has a way of reshaping the holidays. Christmas cards with smiling families flood mailboxes, and a repetitive rotation of holiday songs preaches jolly, happy times. What once felt effortlessly joyful now carries both memory and longing. The absence of loved ones during the holidays is especially sharp. With a more grounded understanding of life's complexities, I have altered how I approach this season and how I reach out to others. I no longer assume the holidays feel merry for everyone. For those coping with grief and loss, I write cards offering support, remembrance, and understanding. Last year, after I sent one to a friend who had lost her sister, she contacted me, grateful for the reminder that she wasn't alone. I've realized that small gestures of empathy can ripple outward, creating connections that matter far more than a perfect gift or festive decoration. As I continue through middle age, I find steadiness in a more nuanced celebration. I lean into my faith as I reflect on the true meaning of Christmas. I offer hope by reminding others they are not alone in what they're facing. I show love through thoughtful gestures, a handwritten note, or an invitation to spend time together. And I still embrace joy as I watch my own children race to their stockings on Christmas morning. That was written by Caroline Lubbers, who is a contributor. And our next one is entitled, Impossible to Cook Without Love. I had been looking forward to hosting a holiday meal for my extended family ever since moving back to California after spending my adulthood in other parts of the United States. I decided to make our vision of the traditional turkey dinner, our version of the traditional turkey dinner, the same one my mother and grandmother cooked, the same one I've prepared since I started my own family. My uncle came into the kitchen, stopping to dip a spoon into one of the pots. "It's my mother's mashed potatoes," he said. It had been years since he'd tasted them. We both teared up a little and then laughed at our sentimentality. Somewhere along the way, I had become the keeper of my family's recipes, the dishes that taste like anticipation, joy, and comfort. I am their protector and purveyor. But this year, that bedrock has teetered on burdensome. Our small family has undergone big changes in the last year with divorce, relocation, and a child off to college. Although I have continued to cook as relationships changed, a way to weather transitions with love and care, I wasn't sure I had tradition in me this year. I wanted to spend my precious little downtime enjoying my daughters in quiet gratitude for the unstoppable good that carried us through 2025. I tried to cancel the big meal. "But you're still cooking, right?" asked my younger son. Canceling was inconceivable, I realized, and I was surprised by my relief. The assurance of a holiday touchstone, the traditions that give meaning to time, they carry extra weight this year. Dinner will be small, just my ex, our two girls, and my niece. With our changing dynamics, I am grateful for the stability of shared expectations, the flavors that snap us back to our best moments together. When I was very young, I asked my grandma how she learned to cook so well. "It's how I show my family I love them," she told me. She could say a lot without answering the question. I think of that nearly every time I turn on the stove. It is impossible to cook without love. I feel it when I pass boiled Yukon Gold potatoes through a ricer so they're fluffy, not smashed, as I stir in the butter in cold chunks at it so that it mixes evenly as it melts, when I alternate that with the milk, steaming hot so the potatoes stay warm and get creamy. Perfect mashed potatoes are just so, and anything else isn't a celebration. My scaled-back holiday meal may not offer many leftovers, but I will see my uncle soon after, and I will save a bowl of mashed potatoes to connect us all. And that was written by Allie Martin, who's a staff writer. And our next one is entitled, Four Words for a More Purposeful Season. As our children grew older, I came to dread the holiday season's bombardment of advertising. Black Friday and the rise of Cyber Monday, the incessant and tiring thought, do we have enough? When we became empty nesters, Christmas was quieter. It was a relief to put away all the old last-minute rushing around, and still, the need for something remained. Then, my wife, Jean, came across a suggestion on social media. Limit gifting to four straightforward categories. Something they want, something they need, something to wear, something to read. It has become, for us, something akin to the four elements. Earth, water, air, and fire. Four gifts, fundamental, plain and simple. It has been a revelation, in some ways even a revolution, in our thinking. Simplify, 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 Thoreau shouted across Walden Pond. The simplification of what to give has opened a broader universe of why, a redirection of focus into the more satisfying realms of quality and usefulness, joy and love, memory and hope. In other words, it's a way that delivers the rest of Thoreau's call, simplicity of life and elevation of purpose. Four words, want, need, wear, read, to simplify, 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 and to allow this time of celebration and reflection to have meaning again. That was written by Jim Middleton, who is a contributor. Yeah, we got two more here. This one's called Here We Come A-Caroling. This might be a controversial position, but I have mixed emotions about Christmas. I have nothing against the spiritual message of the holiday. I just find the commercialism and the inevitable drop of mediocre Christmas albums annoying. But after spending a few years in Saudi Arabia, we found ourselves craving a little Christmas spirit in our home. It's natural to pine for what you don't have. Saudi shopping malls, until recently, were quiet, austere places, filled with happy families and squealing children, but nary a Bing Crosby tune or a Christmas tree to be found. In our case, we craved items that seemed unavoidable back home in the United States. The scent of pine trees and mulled apple cider, the familiar sound of Christmas songs we had been humming since childhood. We also felt the urge to share these things with the friends we had been making in Saudi Arabia. Workmates, neighbors, devout and non-religious, Christians, Hindus, Muslims, and folks who simply loved a good song. Over the years, our carol sings were occasionally boisterous, with Badhran drummers drumming and children shaking tambourines and kazooing. In times of war or economic instability, we had quieter, more intimate gatherings, grateful for each other's company. One year, a teacher from New Hampshire taught us her childhood favorite, Dominic the Donkey, who reportedly helped Santa deliver presents when the reindeer couldn't handle the steep hills of Italy. Another year, we heard a rousing version of Elvis's hit song, Blue Christmas, followed by Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. And one year, we just completed singing the exhausting 12 Days of Christmas when a late-arriving family requested the same song. We sang it again. Every year, we found ourselves ending with Silent Night. There is something about that simple tune that captures the mood of the season as one year nears its end and another one offers the hope and promise of renewal. And that was written by Scott Baldoff, who's a staff writer. And the last one is entitled, Holly Jolly Days Can Happen Anywhere, Anyway. Growing up in Minnesota, my Christmases were just as good as any Hallmark movie classic. There were snowballs to throw, hills to sled down, and plenty of hot cocoa to warm you up afterwards. But after spending my first Christmas with my Spanish now husband at his mother's home in Tenerife, I reluctantly threw my long-held notions of the holidays out the window. The window, as the stories go, was how Santa got inside on the Canary Islands, I soon learned, given that there was nary a chimney in sight. And forget about the woolly sweaters. Instead of curling up in front of a fireplace on Christmas Eve, my husband and his friends spent the 24th swimming at the beach. On Christmas Day, the whole family gathered as his mother sliced thin shavings from the watermelon-sized Iberico jamón shoulder that sat proudly, hoof and all, in their kitchen while cooking up creamy croquetas, quail's eggs, and flan. Meals lasted days, not hours, and where food was a mere background music in Minnesota, it took a center stage here. But something was missing, and it wasn't just the snow. The stockings lay unceremoniously empty. The floor under the fake Christmas tree was bare. As it turns out, Spaniards do not exchange gifts at Christmas at all. Rather, the real celebration is 2 weeks later, when the three kings, not Santa, are said to put gifts in shoes, not stockings, that children leave out for them. All of this was fun and funny until our own children came along. Then the existential questions burst forth. Whose holiday tradition would we celebrate? How? And more importantly, where? At first it seemed important to choose. Below zero wind chill or palm trees. Green bean casserole or tyrone. Gifts on Christmas or Three Kings Day. Whose version of Christmas would win out? The answer to my children's delight is this. Everyone's. Now, presents go under the tree a week before Christmas, to my mother-in-law's utter dismay. 2 weeks later, we put out milk and cookies for Los Reyes Magos, and a bowl of water for their camels. Some years, you'll find us chowing down on cured pork loin and manchego cheese in front of a glorious sunset. Others, it's cranberry sauce and candied yams on a snowy night. Whether we're building a snowman in Minnesota or lounging at the Tenerife beach, our family knows that the holidays can happen anywhere, anyway, our way, as long as we're in at it together. And that was written by Colette Davidson, a special correspondent. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. At the top of the show, I said that we're going to read an article from the Humanity Behind the Headlines section. But guess what? This week they don't have that. But they do have something similar. It's called Global Currents, the Ideas Shaping the News. And so here is one of the articles. It is entitled, 90 Years Ago, the Supreme Court Limited Whom Presidents Can Fire. Trump wants to reverse that. And they've got that paragraph here, why we wrote this. For 90 years, the Supreme Court has restricted the president's ability to fire heads of independent federal agencies. The court, which took up the case on the subject this month, has hinted it might agree with President Donald Trump's argument to overturn that precedent. This is written by Harry Gass, who's a staff writer. Long before he entered politics, Donald Trump became a household name with two words, "You're fired." Having carried him to television stardom, the phrase is also defining his second term as president and his latest high-stakes trip to the U.S. Supreme Court. Mr. Trump has dismissed dozens of executive branch officials, including leaders of a half-dozen agencies who, by law, can only be fired for cause, which is defined as inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance. The lawfulness of one of these firings was argued on December 8th before a court with a six-justice conservative supermajority that has already expressed tacit support for Mr. Trump's claims. The case, Trump v. Slaughter, could have major implications for presidential power and the American public more broadly. If the court rules in the president's favor, the White House would have direct control of the leadership of agencies created by Congress to be independent or quasi-independent from the presidency, insulated from shifting political tides and regulating everything from car seats to the country's financial system. What's at stake in this case is whether you can have independent thinking within the executive branch, says Lauren McFerrin, a senior fellow at the Century Foundation, a progressive think tank, and a former chair of the National Labor Relations Board. Trump's supporters view the stakes as the president's inherent authority to run the executive branch as he sees fit, an authority, he says, flows directly from language in Article 2 of the Constitution, which says the executive power shall be vested in the president. The Slaughter case is an opportunity for the Supreme Court to restore the proper constitutional role of the president as being head of the executive branch, says Hans von Spekowski, a fellow at the Conservative Heritage Foundation and a former commissioner at the Federal Election Commission. Oral argument suggested that a majority of the court appears willing to expand the president's authority to remove executive agency leaders without cause. A 1935 precedent. 5 years ago, the High Court laid the groundwork for this separation of powers dispute. In Sila Law v. Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the court in 2020 held in a 5-4 ruling among ideological lines that the structure of the Consumer Watchdog Agency violated the Constitution. Because the agency was headed by a single person whom the president could only fire for cause, its structure was incompatible with the Constitution, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in a majority opinion. The structure vests significant governmental power in the hands of a single individual who is neither elected by the people nor meaningfully controlled through the threat of removal by someone who is, he added. That decision upheld a 1935 precedent established in Humphrey's Executor v. United States. In that case, which involved the Federal Trade Commission, the court ruled that board members who don't exercise any executive function can only be removed for cause. Rightly or wrongly, Chief Justice Roberts wrote in a Celia opinion, in Humphreys, the court viewed the FTC, as it existed in 1935, as exercising no part of the executive power. Rather, the court at the time saw the FTC, which was created in 1914 to combat monopolies, as a legislative and judicial agency because it provided reports to Congress and gave recommendations to the courts. With the Slaughter case, that rightly or wrongly question has returned to the justices. A slow but sweeping change. The Slaughter case also concerns the FTC. Rebecca Slaughter, a former trade commissioner, sued Mr. Trump after he fired her without cause in March. The symmetry is central to Mr. Trump's argument that while the justices said the president couldn't fire an FTC commissioner in 1935, the president should be able to do so now. The modern-day FTC exercises core executive power and its heads must be fully accountable to the president, Mr. Trump argued in a court filing. The filing cited, for example, the FTC's ability to file civil suits seeking monetary penalties. The Supreme Court has made similar arguments in upholding, on an emergency basis, Mr. Trump's firings of agency leaders, seemingly in defiance of Humphreys. Some justices reiterated those views during the argument in Slaughter earlier this month. Maybe these independent agencies have become something Congress didn't intend or anticipate, asked Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Later, she said that of the independent agencies that exist now, there's nothing that looks like the FTC at the time of Humphreys, or certainly not today. Appearing to be divided along ideological lines, all the justices warned of a potential separation of powers slippery slope should they rule for or against Mr. Trump. If Congress can create executive branch agencies with leaders fireable only for cause, some justices hypothesized, why could they not decide to run cabinet-level agencies with multi-member commissions whom the president could only fire for cause? Justice Elena Kagan called the status quo under Humphrey's delicate bargain that checks uncontrolled, unchecked presidential power. If there's one thing we know about the founders, it's that they wanted powers separated. Congress has given all of that power to those agencies largely with it in mind, that the agencies are not under the control of a single person. None of the high court's actions or arguments to date guarantee Humphrey's demise, but they are signals that the Slaughter decision will likely favor Mr. Trump, legal scholars say. Such a ruling would have a slow but sweeping effect across the federal government. If the Supreme Court comes out and says, we're overruling Humphrey's executor, that will apply to every agency in Washington, says Mr. von Spekowski. The consequences might not be felt immediately, but they could be significant, says Nicholas Bagley, a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. The day after the opinion comes down, nothing much changes. The officers in these agencies remain in these agencies, but they're subject to removal by the president, and that gives him leverage over how they make their decisions. Hypothetically, it means the president could tell the Securities and Exchange Commission, an independent agency that monitors and regulates the financial sector, how to go about its investigations, Professor Bagley continues. Will it matter for a single investigatory decision? It's hard to say, he says, but instead of going it alone, they'll have to look to the White House to pursue whatever policy they want to pursue. Allies of Mr. Trump have argued that the president is more accountable to the public than unelected civil servants, and courts should uphold the president's ability to remove agency heads and staff. A president who uses his or her office to reimpose constitutional authority over federal policymaking can begin to correct decades of corruption and remove thousands of bureaucrats from positions of public trust that have so long abused, wrote the authors of Project 2025, the conservative blueprint for Mr. Trump's second term. The Fed exception. While the conservative justices might have already signaled the end of Humphreys, they have also already carved out an exception for the Federal Reserve in this new legal landscape. It is not surprising, experts say. America's financial stability has long been considered a consequence of the Fed's independence from the executive branch. If political leaders can influence the central bank, the logic goes the bank will favor short-term political gain over long-term economic benefits. In a separate case about Mr. Trump's firing of Gwynne Wilcox, a former chair of the National Labor Relations Board, the court held, again, 6-3, that the president could fire Ms. Wilcox without cause. The two-page emergency order specified that this conclusion did not apply to the Fed's leadership because the central bank is a uniquely structured, quasi-private entity. With those sentences, the Supreme Court was sending a pretty clear signal that they're concerned about the Fed, says Ms. McFerrin. The emergency order has no precedential force. However, so the court would have to formalize this exception for the Fed in an opinion this term. It could be the Slaughter case, or it could be a separate case about Mr. Trump's firing of a Fed governor, Lisa Cook. Mr. Trump says he fired her for cause, specifically over allegations that she committed mortgage fraud. She has yet to be formally charged, and Ms. Cook says there is no basis for the allegation. The case is scheduled for oral argument in late January. Ultimately, the Supreme Court's conservative supermajority appears poised to greatly expand the president's ability to fire leaders of important executive branch agencies. But it also appears there will be legal hurdles to navigate in that process. The conservative justices on the court are pretty committed to that idea, says Professor Bagley. The thing that has slowed them from putting that into operation has been the Fed. Now, he adds, they appear willing to create an exception for the Fed, even while they eliminate the independence of every other agency. And now for The Explainer in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. It's entitled, The History of Snowmen Isn't All Jolly Happy. Here are the frosty facts. And they have that paragraph here, why we wrote this. From political statements to forms of resistance, snowmen have played unexpected roles in history. We round out the record on the rotund icons. This is written by Victoria Hoffman, who is a staff writer. Kids and kids at heart race out to make a snowman after a winter storm blankets the ground. Just as every snowflake is unique, each snowman's size and accessories are limited only by the creator's imagination. Indeed, snowmen of all sorts have dotted front yards and public spaces for centuries. Yet they were not always the jolly, happy figures immortalized in the song and animated television special Frosty the Snowman. From political statements to forms of resistance, snowmen have played unexpected roles in history. To help round out the backstory on our frozen friends, we interviewed a snowman scholar, a jovial fellow with a sparkle in his voice, and even dug up a formula for building the best-looking, three-tiered winter icon. What follows is a question and answer piece. Question: where did snowmen come from? Answer: Although many people assume that snowmen have been around us as long as we have, American snowman expert Bob Eckstein set out to learn who, in fact, made the first snowman. Of course, direct physical evidence of all the previous snowmen is long melted, Mr. Eckstein quips. So he scoured museums, libraries, and other archives, and interviewed historians from all over the globe. His seven-year quest is described in his book, The History of the Snowman. Mr. Eckstein says that researchers and historians have told him that Taoist texts exist from 7th century China that show Buddha's followers were given the blessing to make snow figures of the religious teacher. But Mr. Eckstein found the first known depiction of a snowman, a satirical cartoon figure, drawn into margins that he says mocks Judaism and Christianity in the Book of Hours. This volume of prayers dates to 1380 and is held at the Royal Library in The Hague. Nearly 200 years later, in a winter festival known as the Miracle of 1511, people in Brussels lined the streets with more than 100 lewd and satirical snow figures to protest against the Holy Roman Empire. Mr. Eckstein describes it as an early form of political commentary, a Woodstock-like event held by illiterate residents who felt otherwise powerless against their rulers. At that point, you couldn't read and you had no voice or platform in the sense of a newspaper or anything, he says, but you can make something on your street corner. Snowmen have also played a cameo in violent events. Mr. Eckstein confirms accounts from folklore that say, in 1690, two Dutch guards assigned to the gates of Fort Schenectady in eastern New York decided they wanted to take a break to go to the local pub in their Dutch settlement. They made replicas of themselves out of snow and left their post. While they were away, Native Americans and French troops attacked the fort, killing 60 people, according to a 2010 Schenectady County Historical Society newsletter. The French used snow figures as a symbol of resistance in the Franco-Prussian War. During the frigid siege of Paris in 1870, artist Alexandre Falguière crafted a 9-foot-tall snow sculpture of a naked woman on top of a cannon, a creation that became a beacon of hope during the conflict. In the latter part of the 19th century, Mr. Eckstein's research found snowmen started to appear on trading cards in the United States. Starting in the 1920s and 30s, they also were used in ads from everything from Cadillacs to Mobil Oil. Question: how did snowmen become popular figures for the holiday season? Answer: in 1950, songwriter Steve Nelson and lyricist Walter Jack Rollins created a tune about a jolly, happy soul with a corncob pipe and a button nose and two eyes made out of coal. In 1969, Arthur Rankin Jr. and Jules Bass based their animated Christmas TV special, Frosty the Snowman, on that song. The popularity of snowmen has only snowballed from there, and Frosty has been a beloved symbol of the season ever since. As the song cheerily says, thumpity thump thump, thumpity thump thump, look at Frosty go. And the final question, what's the best way to build a snowman? And the final answer, in 2016, James Hind, a British mathematician from Nottingham Trent University, created a formula for building the perfect classic snowman, formed from three giant balls of snow decreasing in size from the bottom up. His complex equation attracted a flurry of media coverage, including in USA Today and the Daily Mail in London, breaks down the sizes to make the most aesthetically pleasing figure with a strong foundation. First, build the three balls from freshly fallen snow, aiming for a total height of about 5 feet 3 inches. In line with the golden ratio, the snowman's bottom ball should be 31.4 inches in diameter, followed by the middle section at 19.6 inches, and the head at 11.8 inches. Next, gather three rocks or other round objects for buttons, place each one an equal distance apart on the middle ball. Then, find two sticks to form a pair of spindly arms. On the face, the carrot nose should be 1.6 inches long, and the objects forming the eyes should be no more than 1.9 inches apart. Finally, open your closet and have fun accessorizing. Bundle up your snow creation with a hat, scarf, and gloves. Of course, be mindful that Old Man Winter and every snowman is ephemeral. We suggest snapping a selfie so that your new snow-packed pal is frozen in time forever. Well, we have about 2 minutes left, so there's no way I'm going to be able to read both the home forum and the monitor's view. So why don't I go to the numbers in the news column, and this is a bunch of statistics. 8.83 million. That's the amount of square miles, the maximum size this year, of the ozone hole over the Antarctic. It's the fifth smallest since 1992, indicating that control of ozone-depleting compounds is aiding recovery of the atmospheric layer that helps shield Earth from ultraviolet rays. 45. That's the dollar fee to travel by air without a real ID or other approved identification starting February 1st. The Real ID Act was passed by Congress 20 years ago to create federal standards for IDs like states' driver's licenses. 38.9 million. That's the dollar settlement reached between Starbucks and New York City. The company will pay $35.5 million to workers and $3.4 million in civil penalties for violating the city's Fair Workweek law. 94. That's the percent collection rate achieved in some months by Romania in beverage container recycling. In 2 years, residents have widely adopted the new deposit return system. 3,000. That's the number of farms in five provinces of Italy and about 295 dairies that are officially allowed to make cheese labeled Parmigiano Reggiano. The cheese now has representation in Hollywood to promote entertainment product placements. And 12. That's the amount of conscience from a 6,000-year-old settlement in Spain that were tested and played like trumpets by researchers. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor Weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.